We went and shot the Kirkwall Bah, of course, which is fantastic and gets at the whole, you know, the roots of football. You know, we could talk about that, and we've got footage about that. We've got some great interviews in the film with David Goldblatt. So we kind of look at the, you know, the emergence of soccer and how it relates to these ball sports that emerged on other continents like Ulama in Mexico and Suju in China. So, you know, we get into some of the historical stuff, but a lot of it is around why we play and that piece of it.
Hello and welcome to Dummy. My name is George Qureshi. I'm the editor of Howler Magazine. And today I'm talking to a guy who I've known for a couple of years now. His name is John Fox, and he is an anthropologist. A couple of years ago, I was an editor at a book publishing house, and a manuscript, or maybe it was just a proposal, I forget, came across my desk, and it was by John, and it was about ball sports, why we play them, how they came to be played, the meaning that humans ascribe to them, and ultimately, what it means that a bouncing or rolling ball can make us almost universally want to run around and chase it and kick it and throw it and catch it and just play with it. And so, John, welcome to the program. I was so glad to see that that the book was published. I had left by the time that it came out, but now you are making a documentary about the same subject.
Yeah, well, first of all, I have you to thank. I think the fact that you saw something in this book is a big reason why we're talking today. So first off, hats off to you. But yeah, the genesis of the book and now the film was kind of this innocent moment of play with my son, Aiden. He was 7 at the time. Now he's 14. And we're playing in the backyard, you know, a game of catch, actually baseball. And he has this little existential moment that 7-year-olds tend to have. And he says, "Hey, Dad, why don't we play ball anyway?" And he's kind of looking at this thing in his hand and having this sort of out-of-body experience. On the one hand, one of those throwaway questions, you could kind of say, oh, you know, because it's how we learn about the world, or, you know, some fatherly moment of advice. But for me, as an anthropologist and somebody already interested in this topic, I just thought, wow, that is... it's both an innocent question and a profound question. And that kind of set me off on this journey.
And so you spent the next couple of years traveling around the world looking at the genesis of a bunch of different ball games. What did you learn? What are some of the commonalities that you found among the games you were investigating?
Some of the things I learned that were revelations is from the science of looking into these games. The obvious dimensions are these games we play, particularly with balls, are like social glue. They form kind of a universal language that connects us all. You can walk into a village almost anywhere on the planet with a ball, and if you throw it to somebody, they'll catch it, throw it back, or if you kick it to somebody, they'll kick it back to you. So there's something very profound there that I think connects all of these games, despite all of the rules. So the first thing was really the social dimension. We play these games because they are a way that we communicate with each other. It's the way that we compete with each other, but also cooperate. And I think in that sense, they are obviously really universal. Another is, despite the focus on the physical benefits, there's been a ton of science done and studies showing that playing these games actually makes us smarter, that it, from an early age, it helps form our thinking and our cognition. And in our evolution, probably our ability to play is a big reason why we are the thoughtful beings we are today.
Yeah, so something that comes to mind when you say that is this idea that the sport that you play, or the sports that you play, help shape your culture in some way. And something that American soccer fans are, you know, maybe inordinately proud of is the idea that we have very good goalkeepers. So I'm wondering if there's something about the other American sports, which, you know, maybe focus a lot more on hand-eye coordination, you know, football, baseball, basketball, that, you know, might help us develop particularly strong goalkeepers. Was there anything that you found that might support that?
It's a good question. I don't think that it's that determinative. I think there's a lot of reasons why we culturally and nationally become obsessed with a particular sports. I think if soccer, for example, had come along earlier in its modern form to the United States and maybe had been introduced in a different way, we might be more passionate about soccer today than Americans typically are. We already had a field of sports at that point, you know, particularly baseball and even American football, that were in our psyche and in our culture. And I think that says a lot about why we are particularly fixated on those sports as Americans.
Oh, man, I was kind of hoping for a really simple affirmation on that one. Anyway, you also went to Scotland and you write about a ball game there called Ba, and it's almost prehistoric. It's this game where they drop a ball in the middle of the town. You and your team have to move it to whatever gate you're supposed to get it through. And the thing that makes this difficult is that the other half of the town, the other team, is trying to prevent you from doing that by pretty much any means necessary. It's sort of like a tug of war meets a mosh pit meets rugby. In fact, I think it became rugby. So can you describe how this game evolved from this really primitive town-wide thing into the modern sports that we know today?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Kirkwall Ba is a game that's played just twice a year on this tiny island off the coast of northern Scotland in the Orkneys. There's two sides, and one side is called the Doonies because they live on the downward side of town. The other is the Uppies, who live on the upward side of town. Where you're born on the island determines whether you are an Uppie or a Dooney for the rest of your life. So you can't change sides. It's kind of the only real rule of the game. So the Uppies are trying to move the ball from the center of town to this wall on the upper side of town, and the Doonies have to submerge it in the bay. And otherwise, there's you know, really no rules. So it's this fantastic communal rite where hundreds of men are in this massive scrum for hours as they try to move this ball from one side of town to another. And they've been playing this way for hundreds of years. So I went and watched this game, and we filmed it for the movie Bounce. What's spectacular about it is this is really where all sports, all versions of football came from, was this kind of primitive rite, but one that really united everybody in a kind of tribal way. In medieval times, it might be one parish versus another or one village versus another, and there was all this symbolism associated with it. So that's how it was played for hundreds and hundreds of years. Once you reach the 19th century and this game of football almost vanished because it was so violent and because it was disruptive to these villages in England and France, it was preserved in the public schools where the elite children of the aristocracy went to be educated. These different public schools like Rugby and Eton developed their own versions of this game behind the closed ivy-colored walls. And it's really from those versions of the game played in the public school that the rules of modern-day football or soccer emerged.
That's so fascinating. Wait, and rugby too? Is that right?
Yeah, that's where you saw the split between a game that involved handling the ball in a physical way and a game that didn't was really out of these different traditions.
And so is that where it became, I guess, less dangerous? I saw footage of Ba, and it just looks like a free-for-all. I mean, people are fighting and clawing at each other.
A big part of modern sport is the imposition of rules and the idea that you can have association rules for game. Because for most of history, up until that moment of time, rules were just the sort of traditions of how you decided to play the game in your particular town or village. There were no bodies or organizations. There was no FIFA. There was none of that. It was just, this is how my father played it and my grandfather played it. And if you go and you watch the Ba, there really aren't any rules. It's kind of a free-for-all. There are kind of standards, and nobody sucker punches the other guy, or at least not too much. But yeah, once modernity gets a hold of the game, of course, you know, rules get imposed. And part of that is to really make the game safer and more civilized.
I remember you writing about an ancient Mesoamerican game played with a rubber-based ball. Can you describe that?
Sure. Ulama is the name of the game. It is really the oldest continuously played sport on the planet, not very well known. The interesting thing is that while the Europeans in medieval 16th century or so were playing with these balls filled with air or stuffed with sawdust. The Mesoamericans, the people of Central America and Mexico, had these rubber trees. And they figured out a few thousand years ago that they could tap those rubber trees and turn them into these balls that bounced. So they developed this sporting tradition in parallel, which was the first one to actually discover and use rubber in a sport. And of course, the difference is extraordinary. You had spectacular athletic competitions there in these stadiums with teams facing off against each other, and they would hit the ball with their hips because it's the only safe way to hit a 9-pound solid rubber ball is with a hip with a lot of padding on it. It's not something you want to kick or hit with your hand or break a stick over. So yeah, fantastic tradition that emerged there. And what the Spanish accounts of coming over and encountering rubber are great to read because they'd never seen anything like it.
So you are currently turning your book, The Ball, into a documentary called Bounce. Where are you in that process?
We are in the editing phase now, and we're hoping to have something that will be shopping to festivals in kind of mid-summer. So yeah, it's coming along.
Now, you've shared a clip from the film with us, and we've put that on our website. You can see that at howlermagazine.com. And it shows like a middle-aged man in a rural African village. I think it's in the Congo. And he, in the beginning, is walking around sort of picking up scraps of paper and plastic bags and twine from the ground. And he constructs, you know, over the course of a couple minutes, this ball. Like, it's a really nicely spherical, round ball. And he gives it to some kids. And, you know, at first, the kids are kind of, you know, in this group, and they start sort of freestyling with it, and it totally animates the environment around them, and they just sort of are all of a sudden having a lot of fun. But then they're playing, and like I said, they were freestyling, and then all of a sudden they start to pick teams and put stakes in the ground as goals and sort of, I guess, start to codify this game that had been freeform and, you know, kind of amorphous. And to me, it sort of demonstrated maybe a larger change that happened with us humans when we sort of learned to take fun and play and make rules around them and form competition. Is that something you were thinking of when you saw this or when you guys shot this as well?
It's absolutely right. I mean, one of the beautiful things about that piece is that it sums up this evolution of these games without speaking to it, just by showing it. Going from unformed matter, which in this case was like garbage, to this object, and from there to this free play, and from there to this regulated or at least rule-governed sport. So yeah, I think that was one of the things we loved about it after the fact, was this really sums up the spirit of the film as we're trying to capture it, but also the substance and the storyline in a really compact and beautiful way.
Now, I know you did a bunch of interviews and there's some narration over the course of the film, but what I loved about that clip is that it's 6 minutes of pure visual storytelling. There's nobody talking over it, telling you what's happening. And it's the kind of thing that I think all sports fans can appreciate and identify with, that process of awakening and discovery. And now I know you wrote the book, and this clip was so good that it suggests that you have someone who really knows what they're doing from the filmmaking aspect. Can you tell me who you're working with? Who's sort of masterminding the film?
Absolutely. I'm working with some incredible filmmakers. They are really the vision behind the film. Jerome Tellier, who's the director, has done post-production work on lots of feature films. David McLean, who's the director of photography, is a National Geographic photographer who has this incredible eye. And Ann Carkeed, who is our producer, just has a great talent for putting a story together. When we first started talking about this film, one of the important things was we wanted to unleash and allow these moments of free play to happen. So what you're seeing is definitely intentional. The film will obviously have interviews with lots of interesting experts, but we have these expansive moments where all you see and all you experience is the pure joy of that moment of play. We've been shooting that in such epic form that we hope people who are watching it in a theater or at home will just want to go out and play.
I know you spoke with David Goldblatt, who wrote the book on soccer history. It's called The Ball is Round. What did he tell you about soccer that helped you understand its place in the landscape of ball games?
He was incredibly articulate in tying together the different moments in history, the way the different civilizations have come together in this game of soccer. We got so much great stuff from him talking about the evolution of football. In particular, I know one moment where he was talking about the variations of football and soccer, the wonderful but absurd competition that soccer has with American football, where you're somehow not allowed to love both of them. He talks about the importance of flow in the game of soccer and how that was something that really was there all along in the game, but was really freed up through some of the rules that were imposed to not handle the ball for the most part and not to allow some of the physicality that exists in rugby and American football in order to really open the game up and allow this continuous flow, which is part of what I think most people who watch soccer love about the game, is that when it starts, it just keeps going. Contrast that with American football. Last Super Bowl, you can crunch that down. There's actually only 11 minutes of action on the field. So American football is about the stops and the starts and the drama and the strategy. It's almost as much or more about what's happening in the commentator's box as it is what's happening on the field. So he spoke to it much more eloquently, but he was just wonderful to interview.
Did you find a correlation between the simplicity of a game and its popularity?
I think that's true. I did, and I fully support that idea. And it's not just soccer, is obviously what we're talking about here and is the most obvious example of that, with 5 billion people sitting around watching last World Cup. But basketball, which is now really the fastest growing sport in the world, is much the same. All you need is a ball and some hoop to throw it into. So I think there's two reasons for that. One is I think it has broad appeal because there isn't the obstacle of learning complex rules. And I think the other part is the lack of equipment and organization needed means more people can easily get into it in many different parts of the world.
So I'm curious about your findings. I mean, what else did you learn? Why do humans play sports?
Well, I think for me, one of the things I learned the most was that it really is part of our being and our cognitive development. I think from an evolutionary perspective, our primate ancestors found objects in the wild, whether they were fruit or stones, or other spherical objects that had certain properties that worked on their brain in a particular way. The hand-eye coordination, the development of their visual systems, all of the things that led to us being upright and using tools and interacting with our world. The ball kind of is the manifestation of all that. Talking to some of the scientists we talked to about the importance of play, it's this fascinating phenomenon because on the one hand, it seems completely frivolous and unimportant, almost by definition. And yet it is incredibly profound and almost certainly essential to our evolution and our survival as a species. So I think for me, what came out was the universality of play, not just among humans, but in the animal world, and how object play in particular binds us together socially and helped us to evolve into who we are today. So really the profoundness of it, I think, is what really crept up on me.
Just to return to David Goldblatt one more time, I remember that in the introduction to his book, he writes, you know, he sets out his intentions, and his intention is to write a history of soccer that stands up academically. You know, he says that war and politics and culture are all studied, you know, fairly seriously. And yet sports and soccer in particular are, you know, it's the most popular, one of the most popular pastimes in the 20th, 21st centuries. And yet academics don't really take it seriously. Did you find when you set out to study ball sports that you were, and that people looked at you kind of funny, that they thought, you know, this is not a subject worthy of your attention?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it goes back to when I was years ago doing my PhD dissertation, which was on the ancient Mayan ball game of Ulama. I remember going to professors and saying I was going to do my PhD dissertation on this sport. And even though that sport was known to be an important part of the ancient Mayan civilization, they were kind of like, really? You're going to do your whole dissertation on this game? Like, why not do it on the political development of this particular region or, you know, something serious? And I think there is a pervasive notion around that. Luckily, we went out of our way to find some scientists who have dedicated their lives to studying play and have turned up really interesting stuff as a result. I think one of the reasons people have not grappled with it is because, frankly, it's so complicated that once you dive into it, you never emerge.
Now, you set off on this quest to answer your son's question, why do we play ball sports? And I'm wondering if your enjoyment of playing around of these games changed as you started to understand why we play them and you know what motivates us to do that.
Yeah, I think so. My son, who's now 14, he's since gone from baseball to basketball. I'm afraid to say he's not much of a soccer player, but he's obsessed with basketball and I go to a lot of games and it does. I think about it a lot because I think about what's happening to him as a young person developing and how this sport means so much to him and how he plays it in different ways. I see him go to the park with his buddies and mess around and play street hoops. And it's a different thing to when he's out with his coach and he's running plays and everything counts. And yet one is not wrong, one isn't right, but they're totally different. I can almost envision different parts of his brain firing at different moments or different things happening in his social world as he experiences the game in these different manners. So I guess, yeah, the answer is I think a lot about it, yet it still doesn't get in the way of me just enjoying the moment of play.
I'm intrigued by that idea because one of the things that's happening in American soccer right now is we're looking abroad to successful youth systems in other countries, you know, especially the Dutch and the Spanish systems are, you know, well-known examples because they foster a type of play that doesn't really resemble the 11-a-side soccer of the pro game. So, you know, you have small-sided games, it encourages fun, it doesn't really place much emphasis on winning. You know, it's really touching the ball and developing technique, you know, which really stands in contrast to American youth soccer and, you know, really all American youth sports. There's that new documentary about crazy football coaches in Texas, like 8-year-old teams, and they're just like treating them like hardened pros. It's kind of crazy. But I know you studied a lot of the grassroots stuff, and I'm curious about what you found pertaining to, you know, the way that we encourage people to play, or especially kids, and the way that that develops into more competitive arenas, because the people who don't seem to emphasize winning are winning pretty much everything, it seems like.
I know what you're talking about. I mean, one of the things that I think is so tragic about modern sports is that we have made them seem way too much like the rest of life. In other words, we've managed to extract and remove the play factor by turning it into something that looks a whole lot more like work. You know, I think there is something fundamentally different that happens when kids play freely and explore boundaries on their own, and they do make up rules. By nature, we are creatures that impose order and meaning on the world around us. And so kids, even little kids left to their own devices playing make-believe play, will create rules on the spot. But it's that act of negotiating with other kids and learning how to be empathetic and learning how to move certain ways, like it's just totally different in free play than it is when everything is being regimented and organized by a grown-up according to some manual. So I think there's important lessons to be learned there. And I believe the Dutch and others are onto something, because I heard an interview the other day with a guy talking about Wayne Gretzky, and there's no ball involved, but Wayne Gretzky, the great hockey player, who when he was like 3 years old was watching hockey games and would cry when they turned the TV off. The guy being interviewed's point was Wayne Gretzky became great mostly because he fell in love with this game at such an early age, deeply in love, and he could not imagine going through a day without playing this game. And that drove him. And I think the important thing is from an early age is that kids fall in love with the game and that love will then guide their talent and not the other way around.
Well, John, I really enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you so much for coming on to Dummy.
Great to talk about all this stuff.
John Fox is the author of The Ball, Discovering the Object of the Game, and he is currently finishing up a film adaptation called Bounce. You can see a clip from that on our website. It's howlermagazine.com. And you can hear more Howler podcasts at howlermagazine.com/radio. Subscribe in iTunes, give us a like or whatever. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, both are at What a Howler, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/whatahowler. My name is George Qureshi. This episode of Dummy was produced by Ryan Catanese. Until next time, thanks for listening.